It's Tuesday, September 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, North Korea threatens yet another detonation just days after its fifth nuclear test.
What is the tipping point toward breakdown or not? People will have to determine that.
Will the latest pause in hostilities hold in Syria? Also ahead, health questions about U.S. presidential candidates. Investors weigh the health of the U.S. economy. And the comedian-in-chief, a joke writer for the president. It's all on today's International Edition. South Korea's Yonhap News Agency, citing South Korean government sources, is reporting that North Korea has completed preparations for yet another nuclear test and may be previously an unused tunnel at its mountainous test site. International Edition's Laurie London talks to Seoul-based journalist Bruce Harrison to find out more.
What we know so far, the South Korean government sources told Yonhap News, which is Korea's largest news agency, basically what they've said so far, and I expect there to be a defense ministry briefing maybe later today here that fleshes this out a bit more or just says the same thing, but what they've said so far is that preparations have been completed for another nuclear test at the North nuclear site Punggye-ri, and they have indications that's happened. They didn't elaborate further to the news service what those indications were. Now, I'm not saying the South Korean government's wrong, but I think we should take this with a grain of salt. If you look back to May, late April rather, they said the same thing. North Korea is essentially ready for a nuclear test. Preparations have been made. They could come at any time. That's the exact language they used today. It could come at any time. Well, they thought maybe because the Workers' Party's Congress, the first one in three decades, was coming, it could happen before that as a way to pump up the country, a big source of pride before the auspicious Workers' Party Congress. Well, it didn't happen. It happened 3 days ago, Friday. So they were not wrong, but it took 3 to 4 months, though they said it was imminent. So nothing's ironclad at this point, but if they're right, then North Korea is ready for another one, I guess.
It doesn't seem like Kim Jong-un is willing to listen to the world outcry over any of this.
Yeah. He laughed at what U.S. President Obama said recently regarding the North's nuclear program, or he referred to the president's comments as laughable. We've seen the strongest sanctions put in place earlier this year. The U.N.'s working up more sanctions now. It doesn't seem like much is taking an impact. And I think at least what I've been reading by a lot of West analysts is that following this latest test, North Korea believes that nuclear deterrence is its best path to survival. It will deter an invasion. And if an invasion still happens, it will stop an invasion. So the nuclear program, not only being a source of pride for the country, or at least that's what the government projects on its people, is crucial to its survival. So Kim doesn't really think he needs to listen.
But doesn't he understand that if he's attacked and he uses nuclear weapons, that they'll be used back on him in his country?
It's a significant risk. That's the risk North Korea appears willing to be willing to take. It doesn't seem to be any compromise on either side at this point. North Korea says it's willing to talk peace, a peace treaty, says it's willing to denuclearize, but only with certain concessions, certain gifts, things from the West and South Korea, but they're not going to make those concessions. U.S., Japan, South Korea, they're not going to make those concessions. So there's this perpetual state of risk that North Korea is willing to accept in order to prolong its form of government.
Seoul-based journalist Bruce Harrison. Time for us now to check out what's trending online with International Edition's social media's G. Abby Lee. She's been following the slump in stock markets around the globe. Hello, G.
Hi, Jim.
What's the latest buzz on the gloomy market conditions?
So Twitter users are pointing out several negative signs in the global markets right now. They include dropping share prices in Europe and Asia, falling commodities, and crude oil prices plummeting to below $45 a barrel. Now, Monday market slumped by the most since Brexit. Josh Rogan is a reporter with Washington Post, and he tweeted a link to the Japanese government's 15-page-long statement that's critical of Brexit. Now, many British government officials are also expressing their thoughts on the pros and cons of the referendum, and Richard Corbett is a good example. He's a member of the European Parliament for the Labour Party, and he still has the hashtag StrongerIn included in his Twitter bio. His handle is @rcorbettmep.
Well, we had quite a bit on the market fluctuations, and we'll hear a little bit more later with Jill Malandrino from New York. What else happens to be trending?
Hashtag Eid al-Adha is a globally trending hashtag, and when you use it, an image of Kaaba shows up automatically. The building is located in the courtyard of Mecca's sacred mosque during the Hajj, and it's a focal point of pilgrims' prayers. I'm sure you've seen that image pop up, right?
Yes.
At first, I didn't really know what it is. It just looked like a black box. But the United Nations shared a video clip of its Secretary General Ban Ki-moon wishing a blessed Eid to Muslims around the world, and the video is captioned as, "Let us draw on our common humanity to build a better world for all." Ban Ki-moon message for hashtag Eid al-Adha. More than 1,000 people retweeted that tweet.
Eid Mubarak means blessed Eid, and remind us what Eid al-Adha means.
Sure, the literal translation of is the festival of the sacrifice, and it refers to the second of the two Muslim holidays celebrated around the globe. That's all for me today. Jim?
Thanks for the wrap-up, G. You can follow us on Twitter if you like. Our international edition stream is at VOA underscore IE. I'm at VOA Stevenson, and G. Abby Lee is at G. Abby Lee. Among the top stories that are trending in Asia, Afghan forces kill suicide bombers and end hospital siege. President Duterte warns U.S. forces out of South Philippines. Australia to strengthen anti-terror laws. North Korea's nuclear test puts new pressure on China. Mao's influence lingers in China 40 years after his death. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at the voanews.com website. And also, if you have a smartphone, try our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. Hours after a sundown ceasefire went into effect in Syria, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry declared it may be the last chance to preserve the country fractured by 5 years of civil war. Kerry said on Monday it's premature to make a determination on the United States and Russian-brokered ceasefire's effectiveness.
The earliest reports are that there's some reduction in violence, as well as a few reports of fighting here and there.
The agreement was announced early Saturday in Geneva by Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. Analyst David Leish of Trinity University in Texas tells VOA's Victor Beatty it's a hopeful sign. However, like the short-lived cessation of hostilities reached in February, he says it faces a number of formidable obstacles.
It's hard to initiate it. It's hard to maintain it without any sort of apparent mechanism to ensure compliance on either side. And then furthermore, there's fragmentation on both sides of the conflict. There's going to have to be a lot of leeway, as there was last February, in terms of continuing sporadic fighting. What is the tipping point toward breakdown or not? People will have to determine that. And then, of course, there's just separating the former Jabhat al-Nusra from the non-jihadist opposition or the approved opposition, because there's so much intermingling of the two, particularly in the north, in and outside of Aleppo and around Idlib. So that remains to be seen. And then there's the question of U.S.-Russian cooperation, if those first two things can be resolved. Certainly there are many U.S. officials, particularly in the Pentagon, who are quite skeptical of the cooperation and don't trust the Russians, and I'm sure the Russians don't trust the U.S., so that's a big obstacle. And then after all that is done, if it is done, then we get to the negotiations for a political settlement, and the obstacles that have prevented a political settlement to date are still there. First and foremost, the disposition of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad.
Is there anything different with this arrangement that there was with the one reached in late February?
Well, it's a little bit more detailed than the one in February. I think there's more knowledge involved from the breakdown of the first one that has been employed in this one to try to arrange conditions to facilitate success, particularly from the Russian and U.S. side. with the Obama administration going out. You know, there's a political horizon there in terms of trying to get some sort of a settlement. So there's a little bit more urgency in Moscow and in Washington. And perhaps with this urgency, they'll lean on their respective allies in and outside of Syria to try to do what they can to meet the terms of the agreement, particularly the cessation of hostilities.
There's an Associated Press analysis of this agreement. It says the Syria deal offers hope, but Russia is calling the shots. It suggests that U.S. strategy seems to rest almost entirely on the good faith of the Russians.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, Russia is the primary stakeholder. They made themselves the primary stakeholder when they intervened militarily last September. And I think the Obama administration, of course, which has been hesitant to assert itself militarily in Syria from the beginning, has acquiesced in that and basically has said to the Russians, if you can resolve this, go ahead and do so. If you can't, you're the ones who are going to be caught in a quagmire.
David Lesh said that he believes Moscow wants a political settlement, albeit on its terms, meaning the Syrian regime, with or without Bashar al-Assad, will remain in power. The road to the White House has taken a few stumbles, literally, as Democrat hopeful Hillary Clinton abruptly left a September 11th commemoration Sunday in New York. International Edition colleague Michael Lippin asks VOA political reporter Catherine Gibson more about the candidate's health.
Well, we know that she's actually gone home to Chappaqua, New York, for a couple of days to recover from what the doctors are saying is a fairly serious case of pneumonia.
How did it affect Hillary Clinton's own campaign schedule for this week?
Well, she's taking the 2 days off, so we know that she was supposed to go to California, and we've switched so that her surrogates are taking over in Ohio for those 2 days.
Her campaign has faced some criticism for not disclosing her pneumonia diagnosis earlier. It said she had been diagnosed with that illness on Friday, but didn't declare that until Sunday after she had a near fainting spell in New York. So how is the campaign responding to criticism that it's not being transparent enough?
Well, that's really interesting because it does really go to the heart of some of the issues that people have brought up about Hillary Clinton and her candidacy, is that she has this lack of transparency. So we know that when she was at the 9/11 memorial on Sunday, she had that kind of fainting spell, and it was initially said that it was very hot out. And then it eventually came out that she had been diagnosed with pneumonia. So really this fact that her campaign couldn't get the timeline and the story straight really opens her up to renewed criticism about her lack of transparency.
Well, how has her campaign rival Donald Trump been responding to Hillary's illness?
It was a very interesting response from Donald Trump this time around. He was actually very mild-mannered for him. He wished her well, said that he hoped that she was recovered in time for the debates. And then he came back and hit her on another issue that Hillary Clinton had over this weekend, which is her comment about Donald Trump supporters being deplorables. He could have gone after her on the health issue, but he chose to go after the more intense political issue where she criticized his own supporters.
But Clinton's supporters also point out that Trump hasn't been super transparent about his own medical situation either. So what is the Trump camp saying about that?
That's right. So they're saying that they are going to release Donald Trump's health records sometime this week on the Dr. Oz show, a popular health show here in the United States, said that he had the physical exam in the recent days. They're just waiting for the final numbers to come in, and then they'll be fully transparent and release them.
VOA political reporter Catherine Gibson. Health is one of the issues that's coming more to the forefront in this campaign, as Hillary Clinton is aged 69, Donald Trump is 70. They happen to be two of the oldest candidates ever to seek this nation's highest office. And with less than 2 months remaining in the presidential campaign, you'll want to follow every step of the way on our website at voanews.com. The health of U.S. financial markets is a concern among investors following a huge one-day drop at the end of last week. An amazing recovery of about half that loss was made Monday as we check Wall Street's pulse with VOA financial correspondent Jill Malandrino from New York.
Think about what happened going into the close about the last 45 minutes of the session on Friday. We saw accelerating selling. The Dow was down almost 400 points and on significant volume. We have not seen heavy volume virtually all summer. All 10 of the S&P 500 sectors were down, with telecom and utilities leading the way. And this was interesting because those two sectors have been strong in 2016 because investors have been using the strong dividends as income sources since bonds and other fixed income instruments yields were so low. Another reason that this was a big deal, considering the markets were down over 2%, over the past 44 consecutive trading sessions before Friday, we were within 1% of an all-time high. We have not seen that since 1995 and before that 1965. So there definitely was complacency in the market. So when you see a reversal of a trend in just one trading session after 2 months of flat trade, it kind of does make you take notice. But going into trade on Monday morning, the futures from Saturday into Monday morning, we expected a little bit more of a sell-off. By 10 o'clock, the Dow was going to positive territory, following on the heels of the S&P and the NASDAQ.
A lot of talk has revolved around the Fed, what actions they may take. We've heard the possibilities of one, maybe two rate hikes this year, and that has people thinking.
It definitely has people thinking, but when you look at the action that we saw on Friday, we needed that kind of corrective action. It is healthy in the marketplace to have up and down days. Having a market that was in a complete uptrend for 2 months or in a very tight range, it makes it very difficult for investors and traders to discern where the new opportunities are. So we do need sell-off days, maybe not quite as extreme as Friday, but they are good to have. I think the bigger fear is the reliance that the market has on the Fed right now and what it's done to overinflate asset classes is really what the big concern is. 25 basis points is a drop in the bucket. I think the biggest fear out there are how the asset classes are so intertwined and how valuations have really gotten high since we've started this easy monetary policy.
Not much effect from some of the down markets around the world.
That's another interesting point as well. Asia was down, Europe was down, and a lot of times those markets take cues from what's happening in the U.S., even though they open and close earlier than we do. So I'm not too surprised there, but I think the bigger concern overall is just because you have one Fed speaker or the other hawkish or dovish moving the markets is a big concern. You can tell it's not human trading. It's, you know, algorithmic trading machines playing ping pong all day long. And with low liquidity and low volume out there, that really exasperates the moves.
The volume is always high from New York. We love it. With great information from Jill Malandrino. Jill, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And be sure to stop by our website for more at voanews.com. Follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE and like us on Facebook at VOA Now. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Democracy in action. That's what the U.S. presidential election is all about. Who's going to be the new president of the United States come November 8th? Tune in to VOA's coverage of the 2016 presidential election. Reports, expert analysis, and more. Professional, up-to-the-minute coverage that can't be found anywhere else, right here on VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
This is VOA's International Edition. As U.S. President Barack Obama's second term is drawing closer to an end, over the past 8 years, many of his wits and jokes have come out to the forefront. Who's the man behind the jokes, and what school does one need to attend to become the joke writer for the occupant of the Oval Office? Well, that's what Ihar Tiahnika of VOA's Russian service set out to discover.
I'm a mellow sort of guy, and that's why I invited Luther, my anger translator.
Hold on to your lily white butts.
Meet David Litt. Until recently, President Obama's speechwriter and the inspiration for his anger translator, Luther.
I spent about 4 or 5 years in the White House writing a lot of speeches, and I got to do several of the correspondence dinners, you know, where the president's telling jokes.
The White House Correspondents' Dinner is an annual event where the glamour of Hollywood celebrities, flamboyance of well-known journalists, and the comedic talent of the most serious man in U.S. all mix together. For a number of years, David Litt has been the lead writer for the humorous remarks delivered by President Obama at this event.
The president tells jokes, but he's the president the day before he tells the jokes, he's the president the day after he tells those jokes, so you need to make sure that he's addressing things that he would be addressing in some form or another, even in a more serious speech. And that tends to be the focus of these topics.
Traditionally, the president pokes fun at the American political and business elite.
No one is happier, no one is prouder to put this birth certificate matter to rest than the Donald. And that's because he can finally get back to focusing on the issues that matter. Like, did we fake the moon landing? What really happened in Roswell?
President Obama also happens to be a really funny guy. He has a real sense of humor, and that comes through, and he knows how to use that sense of humor effectively, you know, when he's speaking in public.
These days I look in the mirror and I have to admit, I'm not the strapping young Muslim socialist that I used to be.
One of the points of these dinners is it's a chance for the president to take himself down a peg, you know, remind people that he doesn't take himself too seriously, even though he takes the job seriously.
Where did you go to school to be a joke writer for the president?
I studied history in college, so I did not study joke writing. I did improv comedy, and I did stand-up comedy when I was in high school. I grew up in New York City, so I used to go to amateur nights and do stand-up. The number one thing you see in successful speechwriters is they tend to be very curious and they tend to read a lot. And they're interested in connecting dots in surprising ways.
Today, David Litt heads the Washington office of the humorous video portal Funny or Die, created by Hollywood actors and producers. Igor Tikhonenko, Dmitry Shahov, VOA News, Washington.
Ihar, by the way, has some great video with that story. Check it out online at voanews.com. You've been listening to International Edition. You'll find us there at our website, also on Facebook at VOA Now, and follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. For director Tracy Carter and engineer Jim Harmon, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Thanks so much for listening to our program. Come back when you can and have a great day. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States welcomes the school year ceasefire recommitment made by Ukraine and Russia and witnessed by the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, or the OSCE. To mark the September 1st beginning of the school year, Ukrainian and Russian authorities agreed to a ceasefire recommitment following a period of the worst violence seen since August 2015. Throughout the conflict, Russia has continued to arm, train, and fight alongside separatists in eastern Ukraine, and attacks by combined Russian separatist forces have killed 59 and wounded 319 Ukrainian service members since July 1st. A similar back-to-school ceasefire last year deteriorated within weeks when combined Russian separatist forces stepped up attacks on Ukrainian positions. This year, Ertugrul Apakan, head of the OSCE's Special Monitoring Mission, or SMM, has urged all sides to implement a full and comprehensive ceasefire. The fighting in eastern Ukraine has taken a heavy toll on the civilian population. More than 3 million people are in need of humanitarian aid, and more than 1.7 million have been displaced. The death toll stands at 10,000, of which 2,000 are non-combatants. Access to education and provision of psychosocial support are crucial to give hope to children and adolescents in eastern Ukraine, said UNICEF's Giovanna Barbaris. Far too many children have experienced traumatic events caused by the armed conflict. We need to help these children now to recover and move on with their life. Only a lasting ceasefire will allow these children to resume a normal life. It is crucial the SMM be allowed to do their job to verify the ceasefire and ensure the withdrawal of heavy weapons. Equally crucial is for Russia to cease its destabilizing actions in eastern Ukraine, honor all its commitments in the Minsk agreements, and end its occupation of Crimea.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.